Okay, let's get going. Welcome, everybody. I want to thank all the teams on doing such a great job in their presentations last Thursday. I have distributed the evaluations to the team so they can look through your comments and oh, there you go. Let me know if you can't read it. I'll let you look at the original. Anybody have any questions, comments? Okay. I had a couple observations on the presentations, and I think it's really important that to really measure the first couple sentences you say to get everybody, make sure everybody's listening, number one, and make sure that you prepare the audience for what you're going to say. So you should, the first couple sentences should really be like an overview of what you're going to talk about for your presentation. And that really gets everybody in the right framework for what they're going to hear and what they're going to see. And sometimes it may be good to for people to have an agenda slide to make sure that that people develop in their mind, you know, folders where all this information is going to go as you present it. And it helps you organize your presentation as well.
Another thing that I'm pretty conscious of is logistics. When you have multiple people doing a presentation, it's always a problem of, you know, where do you stand and where do you stand in relationship with the screen and your computer, and where does the team stand? There were some occasions where team members, you know, a couple team members were over there and one team member was over here, and, you know, maybe that's not such a good idea. I've seen, the best situation I've seen is where the person who's speaking, you know, steps up a step or two and the other people step back, and when you change over, you know, that the person who's speaking steps up and the other people sort of step in the background. But, you know, maybe it would be good for somebody besides the speaker to use the laser pointer. I think you might try that. And another thing, if you're the speaker and you have to hold a lot of stuff in your hand and the laser pointer and everything, that's a lot to manage. So you may want to have one of your teammates, you know, hold your props for you until the right time. So all those will make a much more professional presentation. Because what I'm really looking for in your final presentation is something really professional. So I want you to think of think that your final presentation will be your first professional presentation. You're no longer a student. You're going to be a professional doing a presentation. And I'll talk more about that as time goes on. And one of the things that's really important is to keep track of time. And I'm sorry I didn't have a better timekeeper here, and I'm sorry that some of the discussion went over, but I thought that this discussion was good for the teams. But in the final presentation, I think I'm going to limit your presentation and following discussions to 20 minutes and really cut it off. So make sure you practice your final presentation, not only for the words, but for the time, because that's going to be important. Yeah? Your final presentation and final report should cover everything you've done the whole quarter. So start from scratch. Assume that people in the audience don't know anything. Go through the entire story. The same thing with your report. You can include big chunks of your report that you've done for a midterm and your final. You wanted to tell a story from beginning to end, okay? And I'm in the process of going through the reports. There'll be a lot of red marks on there. A lot of it will be grammar. With your report, I want that as professional as can be, because it's one thing that you can take with you and carry with you and be proud of if you do a good job. And so I want that to be a real memorable thing, you know, for you to take from Stanford in the class, that report. And you'll see, it'll go a long way in your career to do, you know, good reports and good presentations. And I just want to tell you, I'm not the model of a good presenter or report writer. I struggle with that a lot.
But
I didn't know how important it was going to be, but now you know, and so
you can take care of that. On tomorrow afternoon, there's going to be a forum at the VA on emerging technology and the potential for neuroplasticity and ongoing post-stroke recovery. So this is open to the public, and if you can make it, I think it'll be a good one. Am I right?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thought it'd be pretty interesting. Things in the news. I saw the previews for the Celebrity Apprentice, and one of the contestants is Marilee Matlin, who's a deaf actress. You might have known her from an episode of Seinfeld. So it's going to be really interesting to see how her disability, you know, plays into team working and communicating and stuff like that. And it seems like there's a lot of opportunities, sometimes planned and sometimes non-planned, for people with disabilities or people who are famous or in the movies or actors who become disabled that really brings a focus, you know, what their disability is. I'm thinking of people like Michael J. Fox and Muhammad Ali and folks like that. So this might be an interesting experience, and we'll see how well she does. Okay, I'm going to talk about something that's sort of esoteric, and I'm sure I hadn't even heard of this word until October, exceptionalism. And it's not an engineering word. You won't find it in any engineering textbook. It's not a technical term, but it's the perception that a country, society, institution, movement, and I've added group or person, or time period is exceptional in some way and does not need to conform with normal rules or general principles or has special powers or rights. And this is sort of a weird concept, and I have been thinking about this a little bit, about things that happened in my own life and things that happen in current events. And used in this sense, the term reflects a potentially false belief formed by lived experience, ideology, perceptual frames, or perspectives influenced by knowledge or lack of knowledge of historical or comparative circumstances. And some examples of this are on Homer's t-shirt here. It says, "Try and stop us," and you have the cartoon figure of the U.S. embracing the world. And I'll talk more about that on the next slide. And then we have sort of the opposite thing here about Darwin. Whereas before we thought that humans were the crown of creation, but Darwin says, well, no, we're just animals, really. And so that sort of turned that upside down. So it extinguished an exceptionalism concept that people had about themselves. And then you see things like these motivational placards, and I think these are sort of made to be funny, but this one says, "Exceptionalism. Being different and better is a good thing." So
that,
I think,
counts as exceptionalism.
And here's some slogans. And the first thing that I was thinking of is, you know, people thought Earth was the center of the universe, and then maybe not the center of the universe, but at least the solar system, and the both of those proved wrong. And exceptionalism is used mostly as the U.S. is the world's greatest superpower. So by being the superpower, we're better than other people, and then we can do things that maybe somebody that isn't a superpower can't do, because we have, like, nuclear weapons, right? Okay. Some things in my life, I remember
in grade school, we had three reading groups, and they were all named after baseball teams. And my team, we were the top team, we were the Yankees, because the Yankees were the good baseball team. The middle team was the Pirates, and Pirates are sort of cool, but, you know, not as good as the Yankees. And then the low end team, they were the Indians, because Indians are, you know,
are pretty bad. So, you know, we thought of ourselves
as being exceptional because we were in the top reading group.
Okay. Okay. Some other ones, David Letterman says in the opening, New York is the world's greatest city.
I'm not sure
that that's true, but you know, it's okay to say that. And if somebody can tell me where leaders of the 21st century, where that slogan came from, they get an extra cookie. I'll give you a hint. 1955, TV show,
A Mouse with Ears,
Mickey Mouse Club. They said right at the beginning, this show is devoted to the leaders of the 21st century. And they meant me. I was going to be a leader in the 21st century. How do they know? Yeah. It was the narrator that did that. And how about the greatest generation? What does that refer to? See, our generation? No, that's wrong. Spencer knows, maybe. No. World War II veterans, that was the greatest generation. The chosen people? Who knows about that? Jewish people, right. And then you have things, you know, like we are the champions of the world, the Super Bowl champs, World Series champs. Okay, other cookies for this one. Hail to the victors, valiant, leaders of the West, leaders and the best. It's part of a football cheer from my alma mater, University of Michigan. Go Blue. Okay. Oh, humans are the only intelligent life form in the universe?
We don't know that for sure, but,
you know,
that's a pretty high
value to put on us. We're the top of the food chain. We can boast about that, but until you think about, you know, this picture where since zombies eat humans, that maybe zombies are on top of the food chain. Or, if I don't know if you can see this, but here's if you're in the wrong environment at the wrong time, you see this white shark behind these divers, so and the white sharks
eat humans too,
so maybe they're at the top of the food chain. And so then you have, you know, people who win Nobel Prizes and have Grammys, Emmys, or Oscars. They always include that in the title when they're introducing them. So the point is that people and, you know, are these people
might consider themselves exceptional and maybe beyond the rules. And we've seen a lot of that, you know, even in our political system, in our ruling system, we see all sorts of people doing wrong things, bad things, immoral things.
And certainly in the past, a lot of things were done, bad things were done for religious purposes. And if you're in first class, you get to use the first class bathrooms in front, right?
So, and maybe you think of yourself as exceptional because you're going to Stanford or going to be a Stanford grad.
And then we have, you know, masters and slaves and stuff like that. And I remember, you know, in high school, you know, I was in honors and advanced placement class, and I thought that was pretty cool, you know, compared to the rest of the people. And then you can have a whole wars fought over being Aryan or not, and being Aryan as the supreme genetic, you know, humans. So
so what's the point of all this?
Well, the point is, I think, it's okay to look up to somebody as or a principal as an ideal and recognizing unique contributions and talents. But it's another thing to put yourself on a pedestal looking down and claiming superiority over something. Because when you do that, you
create groups. You can create, you know, the superior group and the inferior group. You partition people into those things.
And once you do that,
and if you happen to be in the ruling class where you make all the laws and control all the money,
you might have a situation where you
say, well, those people down there are maybe less deserving of the money that I have control over, and maybe they're less deserving because they're poor or they are disabled or whatever
purpose. So it's important to
consider this. And you see this all the time.
And even Bill Geary talked about this, and he mentioned this, there by the grace of God go I.
And that's sort of creating a separate thing. You know, there's a person who says this and says, look at that poor person over there. You know, if, you know, that could be me. But it isn't so.
And so he's saying, you know,
that he's saying in this, you know, that he is superior to that other person. Does it make any sense?
Okay.
Just something that's on my mind. So, you know, it has a lot of ramifications, and you see this a lot in how resources are allocated, I think. I'm not going to get into that.
No. So on Thursday, we're going to have Dr. Jessica Rose and Adam Shepard talk about gait, cerebral palsy, and functional electric stimulation. So they're going to be talking about how people walk and what happens when folks don't walk normally, and research that they're doing to remedy that situation, especially with kids with cerebral palsy. So that'll be pretty interesting. But today we have Terry Adams for the fifth time, once a year. I always look forward to Terry's talk. Every year Terry talks about something different, and it's great, always good. So Terry Adams is the Assistant Director of the Office of Accessible Education and the Student Disability Resource Center. The center is committed to providing Stanford students with disabilities the support and services needed to allow them the opportunity to participate in the rich and varied life here at Stanford. In addition to academic accommodations for students, Terry also expedites all housing assignments and facility requests related to disability. So let's give a warm welcome to Terry Adams.
Try very hard not to drop that on the floor. I got it.
And the right arrow is forward.
Okay. Okay. So I have a number of disclaimers. I have a cold, so I'm even more discombobulated than usual. And I had a hard time focusing this year. Whenever I know I'm speaking in Dave's class, and like he said, this is the fifth year, I try to focus on something that's bugging me in particular. And this year there were so many things bugging me that I couldn't quite narrow it down. But one thing that I'd been noticing this year, because I deal with students, is that most of the students that I see, and I deal with every disability type except learning disabilities, and there are other professionals in our office that assist students with learning disabilities, is that, you know, students, let's say, between the ages of 18 to 22, 25, don't seem to have a real sense of how things were before they came to Stanford, before they got in, before students with disabilities were integrated, before there were services, before there were curb cuts, all of those sorts of things. And so the bulk of my talk this year is kind of looking back to where it was when I started out, and what's changed and what's not changed. The other thing that really struck me this year, because I took a brief trip to New Jersey in October, and I flew without my power chair because I don't trust the airlines to not break my power chair, and it struck me at how much more disabled I felt because I didn't have my power chair. I was dependent on somebody else to drive me around because there was no public transit that was accessible. I would go into restaurants and the bathrooms would not be accessible. And so it really struck me that the extent to which one feels disabled or one is actually more functionally disabled depends on these types of issues and where you are. So starting from the beginning, I was born, like David Copperfield, in 1957. And these were the things that enabled me, the main thing that enabled me to survive in 1957 was that antibiotics had already been invented and were easily available to the doctors that were treating me. If I had been born prior to that, when antibiotics were undiscovered or hard to come by, I probably would have not made it out of infancy due to skin infections. And these are some of the other things that were already in use. Clearly, wheelchairs and power wheelchairs have advanced by leaps and bounds since 1957, but they had been invented then. Doctors didn't really know what to make of my disability. It was not, you know, clearly they knew it was a skin disorder. I was born with it. They told my parents I would outgrow it. Fortunately, I never believed that. So when I started school in 63, none of these things were in my environment. Curb cuts, braille signage, wheelchair ramps on buildings, accessible restrooms, power doors. The only power doors I remember were on grocery stores. No accessible buses or trains or light rail. And you never saw horns and strobes anywhere. When I started school, none of the laws that protect the civil rights of people with disabilities had been passed. And routinely, kids with severe physical disabilities, if they got any education at all outside of at home, they were in segregated schools. And I grew up in San Mateo, which is about 15 miles up the road from Stanford. I was in a segregated school from 1963 until 1971. And when I went to high school in 71, I was still considered a special ed kid, even though I was in a regular high school. The Education for All Handicapped Children Act, which is later renamed Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, wasn't passed until 1975, too late for me. 1968, the passage of the Architectural Barriers Act happened, but it only applied to buildings that received some kind of federal funding. And I make note of the fact that Ed Roberts, who is a hero in the disability community, and his group called the Rolling Quad started attending Berkeley in 1970. So I had not even started high school yet when he was forging those paths. And he started the first CIL, Center for Independent Living, in Berkeley in 1971. So I have a couple of slides with just a timeline of when the laws were passed. This will be up on the website. You know, it's not like you're going to be tested on this. It's, again, it's just to give you a perspective. So Section 504 of the Rehab Act, which still informs a lot of accommodations today, including at Stanford, says that any entity that receives federal funds can't discriminate against students with disabilities, people with disabilities, and that, as much as anything else, forms the legal underpinnings for academic accommodations today. So that was passed in 73. In 75, I went to junior college. There was a resource program there, but it was, I would venture to say, very ineptly run. And I was fortunate that I didn't need any academic accommodations. The regulations for 504 were held up for years, and it wasn't until disability rights advocates and people with disabilities staged a sit-in in 77, and then they finally passed the regs. Also, protests by people with disabilities regarding accessible public transit by an organization called ADAPT, started in this in 78, and they would do everything from chaining themselves to buses to lying down in the street to highlight the fact that transit was not accessible. Yeah. I know. They'd arrest them and then they couldn't get them to jail. The paddy wagons weren't accessible either. So, 78, I got my first full-time job and lost it after about 6 months when the president of the company decided that I was very likely going to raise their insurance costs. They didn't tell me that was why I was let go. I found that out later. In 1980, I got another grown-up job. I had that job for a long time, but I was stuck because I had a visible disability and they weren't going to promote me to a role. At Visa, you work with banks, and they didn't want me to be exposed to the members, which were banking institutions. So I left there. So the ADA was passed in 1990. At that point, I was just about to start law school. The big three in my mind of the ADA are employment. It prohibits employment. It prohibits discrimination on the basis of disability in all aspects of employment. Had that been in effect when I had my first two jobs, arguably, I would have been able to advance. The second one is transportation. It's a huge issue for people with disabilities because either you can't drive or you can't afford a ramp van. Excuse me. So public transit is a huge component of your life. The third one is public accommodations. So public accommodations are any private entities that offer a service to the public. So stores, restaurants, theaters, doctors and lawyers' offices are supposed to be made accessible to people with disabilities. So in red, I have 1993 is when I graduated from law school, and I had a couple of jobs after that, both of which I lost because their funding ran out. In 1995, I was told that I didn't get a job because of my disability, even though in 1990 the ADA had passed. People were still not cognizant of the fact that you can't tell me that any more than you could tell an African-American person that they didn't get the job because they're black. And here in the couple more recent laws passed, the most recent one, in 2008, the Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act was passed to correct. There were a lot of bad court decisions that really weakened the ADA, and the Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act, or ADA, was in large part promulgated to correct those bad decisions. So I'm 53, and so going from 1957, when we didn't have all the things that I mentioned earlier, here's where we are now. So a lot more curb cuts, not everywhere. You still will, if you're in San Francisco, this has happened to me in Menlo Park, you can approach a block where there's a curb cut, and you go down the street to the next corner and no curb cut. So you need to hope that there's a driveway, or you could endlessly go around the block, I suppose. Accessible transit is a lot better. It's still not great, and it really depends on what city you're in and the level of consciousness. I can't call a cab in Santa Clara County and get a ramp van, which sounds like it might not be a big deal, but if you miss the last light rail or you miss the last Caltrain, it is a big deal. Most buses are accessible now, I find, at least in the Bay Area. And one thing I spent a lot of time researching this weekend was the Caltrain 2-wheelchair-per-train rule. So very few people know that Caltrain, it is accessible. They have lifts and they have a ramp if it's the bullet setup. But they will only take 2 wheelchairs per train, not per car, per train. And I have been left at the station a couple times since January because the train comes, they've already got 2 wheelchairs, you don't get to go. What's the rationale for that? Well, it depends on who you ask and on what day. I've had people tell me it's safety. They haven't allowed room for it in the car where you're supposed to sit if you're in a chair. There's essentially enough room for 2 wheelchairs to face each other or be in a row. You can often fit 3 if you turn at right angles, but the conductors are told not to do it. I've been told that the real reason is they don't want the downtime in the station because they have to load you and unload you. But the law is very confusing, so I was looking at both Department of Transportation regs and ADA regs about this issue, and as far as I can tell, this was the rule in 1990, and by 2005, they were supposed to be able to take 2 wheelchairs per car, not per train, and they are still operating under the 1990 rule. And, you know, it's not a good time to fight anything with Caltrain because their money is going down the tubes and they're cutting service. And people with disabilities, I would argue, are affected more by that than non-disabled people because it's one of the best ways to get up and down the peninsula if you don't have a car. That's one of the things that most bothers me. I think it's just a basic civil rights issue. There's no other group of people. Yeah. I think that's a psychological. I think that's no. See, yeah. No, I had a conductor say that to me very sincerely. That, you know, oh, if something happened, we would be coming to you first. And my response is, why? I mean, there's little kids running up and down the aisle. Nobody's got a seatbelt on. If the train derails, why would you go for the 2 people? Who are in chairs before anybody else? There's no affirmative action to save the disabled people. And there's nothing in the law that says your mandate is to rescue these people first. There's no requirement to tie down wheelchairs on the train. It just doesn't make any sense. Yes. Well, the rail systems I've used the one in Portland, I've used the one in San Diego, and I would call both of those light rail systems, and they're very accessible. BART is very accessible. BART is more accessible now than it was in the 90s when I was using BART to deliver legal papers and stuff. Yeah, that's what I was talking about, New Jersey. I've flown. That's a whole other story. But I would say, and I don't fly that often. I fly about once a year, and it's a whole other story. It's a whole other hour, really. But for the most part, the services I've received have been pretty good. Yes?
So I think Santa Clara has, like, the ready, you know, ETA runs these vans that will pick up people with wheelchairs.
They have a service called Outreach. Well, that's a very debatable issue as to whether a paratransit is better or not. Outreach, I don't use Outreach. Outreach has an application process. You have to have a certain level of disability to use Outreach. Basically, you have to say you're too disabled to use public transit for whatever reason having to do with your disability. It's not an on-call service. It's not like a cab. You have to make arrangements several days ahead of time for your rides. They're notoriously late, and the 4 hours that you're talking about could be, that was the only time I could get my ride. So for my 15-minute doctor's appointment, I spent 4 hours getting there and getting home. My feeling is that it's not an equivalent service to public transit if a non-disabled person can get a bus or a light rail or whatever when they feel like it. I shouldn't have to decide on Monday if I want to go to lunch on Thursday. And if somebody calls me on Monday, or if somebody calls me on Thursday morning and says, "Would you like to go to lunch today?" Oh, I'd love to, but I can't get there. So, paratransit, according to what I was looking at the other day, is intended to supplement, not replace, accessible public transit. It's for people who can't use public transit for some reason or another. And the delay that you mentioned about people getting on and off, briefly, a couple things about that. One is that the tying people down in the bus, it's a safety concern, but more than that, it's a legal concern. People get sued. Transit agencies have gotten sued by people who've gotten hurt in bus accidents, so they now make VTA tie you down. So that takes driver time. It makes everybody resent you. It's not my favorite thing. I don't ride the bus if I can help it. On the light rail, you get on and off yourself. With my level of disability, I don't need any assistance whatsoever to use the light rail. And it doesn't slow down anything. So my hope would be that as things move forward, the accessibility of the vehicles themselves is improved so that people can be as independent as possible. Oh, and I just mentioned the renting. You know, people can rent a car if they travel, or if they need a car for a week, let's say, because either their vehicle breaks down or they have people visiting from out of town. It's extremely more expensive to rent a wheelchair-accessible van at $100 a day. That's about the going rate, I think. And it has been for a long time, versus a wide range of cost for a car. And you have tons of choices for cars. So again, improvements in the physical environment. There's a lot more Braille signage, although I'm sure Nicole would have a lot to say about where it's placed and how accurate it is. I do find you're much more likely to find accessible restrooms in stores and restaurants, particularly if they're newer because the county requires them to upgrade the restroom facilities. But I also, every year, this happens multiple times, I'll use a restroom in a place and they're keeping the cleaning cart in the stall. That's the accessible stall. I went to a beauty parlor in Gilroy with my sister, and she said, oh yeah, it's got an accessible bathroom, and it had so much shelving for supplies in it that I had to leave my wheelchair in the hall. And once, you know, nobody is going around policing this stuff, and it's the chicken or the egg, you know. I've had business owners say to me, well, people in wheelchairs never come here. Well, maybe that's because they know they can't use the restroom. So it's still a big issue today. Older buildings, more and more retrofit with entrances that are accessible. Stores are getting better. They're not great. My boss was just telling me that the Macy's at Stanford is much, much better now. The Macy's on Union Square is still really bad as of December. Restaurants, this is a perpetual problem, and I don't usually make a fuss because, you know, I know with restaurants, the more tables they have, the more money they think they're going to make, but invariably, unless they put you right by the door, if you get there and there are not many people, you can check in, but you can't check out, just like a Roach Motel, because you squeeze down the aisle, and then all these other tables fill up, and then everybody has to stand up to let you out. Assistive technology is a lot better now. There's a much greater variety of wheelchairs. On the other hand, getting your insurance or getting Medicare or Medi-Cal to buy you the chair you actually need is a big struggle, and I don't think that's going to get better anytime soon. Hearing aids are much more sophisticated and work for more people now, and I just noticed that Stanford's employee, my insurance now pays for hearing aids. It didn't last year. Which is a big step forward. I guess that's the aging boomers. Yeah, Nicole.
Can I have your insurance?
What?
Can I have your insurance?
Well, you just have to get Stanford to hire you. But there's a $5,000 cap. So, and that's the same for me with wheelchairs. There's a $5,000 cap on any durable medical equipment per year. So, there's literally no way for me to get a new wheelchair and have it all covered. Cochlear implants are also my assistant told me that I think cochlear implants were, I don't know when they were invented, but they're much more commonplace now. Hip and knee replacements, too. Although, as Dave knows, I've had both hips replaced. And there's a recall on my first one. But I haven't had any trouble with it. It's my good one, so I don't know. I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop, waiting for the other hip to drop. And there's a lot of really cool technology now that's a lot better. The trouble is getting somebody to pay for it. The cough assist device that I actually saw mentioned from Angelo's presentation earlier this quarter, portable ventilators for people who use chairs who also have breathing problems, tilt and space wheelchairs for pressure sore relief, a variety of augmented speech devices for people that have trouble speaking. Speech recognition software is getting better and better. I think the internet is a huge boon to people with disabilities on a tremendous spectrum of levels. Exchanging information, social interaction, finding out, I can research the law now easily from home. It's even more of a boon, I would argue, to people with disabilities than it is to non-disabled people. Bad news. I just had somebody call me the other day saying, I'm going to be graduating. I can't find a roll-in shower anywhere in the vicinity of Stanford. And it's like, yeah, I know. I don't know. I know that it's an appropriate accommodation that Stanford provides housing for students in chairs that have roll-in showers, but I think it gives people a false sense of what's going to be available to them once they graduate, because here they just get it, and out there it's search for it, pay somebody to adapt someplace. It's really, really hard. This year I had fun with batteries with the durable medical equipment situation. It seems like every year I tell some nightmare story about wheelchair issues. This year it was two sets of bad batteries, finding out that I thought they were giving me gel batteries, which are spec for my chair. They were giving me wet acid batteries and hadn't told me. So if I'd tried to fly with my wheelchair, I would have been lying to the airline about that, which was really exciting to know. I just got good batteries after 6 months last week. So stuff like that is really frustrating. Incoming frosh and students that are looking at Stanford, one of the things that I'm asked when the student uses a chair is, you know, who do you use? Who's a good vendor? I can't in good conscience recommend anybody I've ever dealt with, which is pretty sad. I could tell them a good car mechanic, but not a wheelchair vendor. Oh, and that's my Caltrain rant. And one of the trends that I've noticed that really disturbs me, but is hardly surprising, is so now that the law says that you can't discriminate against people with disabilities in employment, you can, however, if you are trying to hire garbage collectors, for example, you can list the fundamental aspects of the job that they need to be able to do. So whether it's pick up 50 pounds or more, jump up and down off the garbage truck, whatever it is, you can list all of those things as requirements, as essential functions of the job. And what I'm finding is people are posting what I would call extremely sedentary desk jobs, white-collar jobs, and listing all kinds of physical requirements. Like I saw a listing for the job I do at Stanford at another school that said you had to be able to climb and crawl and lift 50 pounds. And it's a stealth way to eliminate people with disabilities from your applicant pool. And nobody's really addressing that one, I don't think. So I had an interesting field trip. In January, I went to the Department of Justice public hearing for rulemaking for the ADA Amendments Act on a couple of issues. And the issues they were looking at included better medical equipment in doctors' offices, furniture requirements for places like hotels. They also discussed better 911 systems for people with hearing difficulties. And there were two groups that were most organized in terms of getting one person after another to come and testify. One group were the people that believe that electromagnetic fields are poisoning them. There was one group after another, one testifier after another about that. But the other group that was very well organized were people, golfers with disabilities, because one of the proposed rules is to make every golf course have an accessible golf cart. And I should have brought a picture of one, but what they are is one of the seats that you can have single seat or a dual seat. The seat for the person with the disability, you put on the seatbelt. It turns and it essentially enables you to stand up and swing the golf club. And so the disabled golfers want every single golf course to have to buy one of them, and they're around $10,000. The golf courses want to create a pool system so that all the golf courses in any geographical area would only have to buy one golf cart, and then you, the disabled golfer, would make an appointment to go golfing, and they would truck the golf cart to the course that you wanted to golf at. And even though I have a little sympathy for the golf course owners who don't want to spend $10,000 on the cart, it's not equivalent. It's the same as the paratransit thing. If I have to decide on Monday that I want to go golfing on Thursday when my friends can all decide on Thursday morning to go golfing, it's not an equivalent service. The bed thing, the reason I have a picture of this hotel and the bed, there were also people talking about the advent of the really, really high beds. And if you've been in a hotel in the last 5-6 years, I was trying to remember when it started, and I think the first time I encountered it was about 2005. And I can stand up and I can, you know, transfer onto a bed pretty much like a non-disabled person, but I'm short. And so I literally have to fling myself on these beds because I can't climb. And so there were people testifying that, and you'll find these beds in the rooms that are designated wheelchair accessible rooms. They need to tell the customers, we have a really high bed in that room. What height do you need? I mean, there has to be a system. Has to be a better way. There are also proposed rules for making the hotels not give away your accessible room, which happened to me when I was in New Jersey, and to enable you to make a reservation for the accessible room through services like Expedia and Orbitz, rather than have to go through a side process, which is the way it is now in a lot of cases. And that's it. Yes? No, it wasn't a group in the sense of an organization. It was just people who have that belief are very active on the internet, and it was clear to me that they had organized amongst themselves that, okay, you call, and then you call, and then you call, and I have to say, if you've never been to a public hearing like that, it was so well organized by DOJ, I was stunned. It was like clockwork, and they had the calls lined up, because you could call in, or you could come in person, and it was extremely respectful. Everybody got their 5 minutes, and but after about 15 of those in a row, that was when I bailed. I couldn't take it anymore. Yeah. Well, so that job that I mentioned, I can't remember what school it was for, but I contacted their HR department and I said, I do this job now at a different school. This doesn't make any sense to me why somebody in this role would have to crawl or climb or lift 50 pounds. And they said, oh, we just put that in all the job descriptions, which is even worse. You know, it's funny, one of the conductors on the train, who's actually one that I like to believe would not leave me behind because he has put me on the bike car before when he already had two wheelchairs. I can't remember what we were talking about, and I think I said something like, he said, oh, you should do this, that, and the other thing, and I said, it's not accessible. Or I can't make it past the door because there's so much inventory in stores. That's what, you know, the store itself might be accessible, except for all the inventory that's on the floor and in the aisle. And he said, oh, you should complain about that. And I said, if I complained about every access issue that I ran into every day, that would be a full-time job. And, you know, plus it takes a lot of emotional energy to keep beating your head against the wall. Yeah. No. No. And so, you know, I could have applied. So let's go back to that job that was like my job here, except it said that I had to be able to crawl and climb and lift 50 pounds. See, it plays out only to the advantage of the hiring party, because if they liked me and I showed up in my chair and I said, I can't crawl, I can't climb, and I can't lift 50 pounds, they could say, sorry, you're not qualified. On the other hand, if they liked me and they hired me anyway, then they could say, oh, well, we waived that requirement, or they could use it on me later if they decided they didn't like me. Well, we realized suddenly that you use a power chair and that you're not walking and climbing and crawling. So, sorry, we're going to have to let you go because you don't meet the essential requirements of the job. Yeah.
That if a place were to discriminate, like, I'm impressed that they even wrote it into the description, you know, because it's like, they could also say we need to hire you because we chose somebody else. You know, like, how can you tell, according to law, like, oh, they're not choosing you because of the disability, or it's just a job?
You can't always tell. You can't always tell, and I've been looking for jobs, you know, I guess my first job up there was 77... 78. The number of interviews that I went on where I thought I didn't get the job because of my disability. Sometimes it's a vibe. Sometimes one of them was interesting. it was a retirement home, and it was a secretarial job, and I set up the interview. They had my resume, and I never, you know, I had to parentally have this conversation with one of my friends. Everybody lies on their resume. Well, I don't, because I don't even apply for anything that I'm not certain I could do from day one, because the expectation or the fear that I won't be able to do the job is so high with a hiring party that I'm just not even going to go there. But anyway, so I get to the interview, and the first question they asked me was, do you take shorthand? No, I don't take shorthand, and it wasn't in the ad, and it doesn't say I take shorthand on the resume, and it was like their killer question. It was the way to get rid of me. So, oh, well, this is, you know, I'm old, remember? I'm 53, so this was 25 years ago. It was a way to take notes really fast. It was a code, and either you knew the code or you didn't, and I didn't know the code. I did know how to type. I told them how fast I could type. That was another thing they used to ask back in the dark ages. So there are appropriate, I think it's possible to have appropriate uses of those have to crawl, have to climb things for the, you know, for the garbage truck guy, for an airline pilot, for people that do have to do physical things, for firemen, for policemen. I mean, there are jobs that can't be accommodated, and I think it's perfectly fine to list them accurately. It's when you use the law to eliminate people from jobs where a physical requirement is not a necessity that I have a problem with it. Yeah. It depends on the organization. Back then, well, a couple of things. My personal experience, my disability is very rare, and I didn't discuss it at the beginning, which I usually do. It's a genetic mutation, my disability. It causes my body to produce skin too fast, and it doesn't break down properly. And so it looks funny. It looks scary to people. And it's so rare, one in 200,000 births, that I might be the only person that you ever see that has my disability. I've only met two other people that have it, and that was at a conference for people that have skin disorders. So, and I was 35. So there are a myriad number of reasons why a person with a disability is the desire is to not hire them. One is just fear. People are afraid of what they don't, what they're not familiar with. And most of the people that have hired me for jobs in my life had someone in their life who had a skin disorder, who had a disability. So they were predisposed to give me a break. But it might be an expense issue. There's also a fear that you hire the person with a disability. If you find out that they can't do the job for some reason, it'll be hell trying to get rid of them because they'll sue you. So if you just don't hire them in the first place, you just don't have to deal with all that stuff. So it's a lot of different reasons. Yes.